Welcome back to Unstable and Unbridled. I'm Liz.
And I'm Rachel.
And we have a special guest here today, host of his own multimedia show, The John and Rick Show, five-star level event rider, coach, CrossFitter, chairman of many different safety committees, and so much more, John Holling. Woo! Welcome.
Thanks for having me. I feel from hearing that a bit like an all-purpose saddle.
You're the Wintech of riding. Oh,
no. That's the nicest thing anybody's ever said. You know, it's too bad I can't be on the show.
So I was looking at the John and Rick show, and your views are in the tens of thousands. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we have a good time with it. It's kind of a new thing for us, and I think like a lot of people, we actually had this sort of started before the whole pandemic thing came. But then when the pandemic hit, we were like, well, we have time to focus on this. And it's been a lot of fun. We're lucky we've got a really good sponsor in Horse Trailer Pros. And yeah, it's been cool.
We're trying to do something similar on a smaller scale. We're also a pre-pandemic startup, but
didn't get started
during the pandemic, because that's when we actually had time.
But I tell you what, like truthfully, I listened to three podcasts. I listened to Dan Patrick Show. I listened to, the Dan Le Batard Show. So two sports shows, and then Unstable and Unbridled.
Woo, we feel honored.
Yeah, and you guys are probably the most controversial show that I listen to.
Yeah, we'll have to get into that a little bit.
Yeah. So we're like the Bates saddle of the podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started, where you're from, your working student experiences, your beautiful wife, your lovely son, and...
Wow, that's a lot to throw at me.
Tell us your whole life.
My whole life.
What time were you born?
So I was born in St. Mike's Hospital in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all downhill from there.
Well, Wisconsin, yeah.
Go Packers. So I grew up in a little town outside of Milwaukee called Mequon. And I actually started riding there and... really kind of a little bit like I'm doing to my son now. I was forced into riding at an early age by my mom because we had a horse, and she was like, you have to come out, you have to ride once a week. And so I did that, and I loved baseball and football and basketball, but sadly I was short and slow and a bit uncoordinated. So it ended up...
All you could do was ride then.
Basically what I discovered is I liked winning. And so I wasn't going to win at any of the traditional sports.
Wait, it is working. Sorry. I panicked.
We're still here?
We're still alive.
Okay. And so I kind of stuck with the horses and grew up doing that and started taking it pretty seriously when I was probably, 14 or 15. And then I was lucky enough. I rode in a clinic in Madison, Wisconsin at Malcolm Stack's farm. He was an older gentleman who evented there, and he had Lucinda Green come in. Oh, and Lucinda sort of encouraged me to try horses, and I remember actually it was kind of comical. I said to her, well, I mean, do you actually think I'm good enough to make a go of it with horses and in eventing? And she looked me right in the eye, and she said, John, you wouldn't believe some of the people that ride out there and try to do this for a living. You'll be fine. And so I... asked her for some help. She put me in touch with David O'Connor, Jimmy Wofford, Michael Plum, and Peter Gray.
So some people were like, okay.
They were okay. Yeah. And so I called around, and Peter seemed like a really good fit for me. It seemed exciting at the time to go to Canada, like go to a foreign country. I'd never really been out of the States other than, I guess, to go to Mexico once or twice when I was a kid. And it was really fun. I moved up there, and, it was interesting. It was sort of like my dad said to me when I went to – so I was supposed to go to college, and I got enrolled at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And I went in for my first day of school, and it was a 7:30 a.m. class, and they did roll.
Too early.
Yeah, but it was for me. I did it because I wanted to ride in the afternoon.
Oh.
Right? So I had all my classes in the mornings. And when they did roll call, I really didn't want to be there. And
I'm not here.
My name, they forgot to mention my name. Like, they missed me on roll call.
This is meant to be.
Yeah, well, a little bit. So the professor said to me, you know, come up to the front if you weren't called. So I went up to the front, and he's like, oh, yeah, you're actually supposed to be at the 7:30 p.m. class across town. You got to go find your guidance counselor, or they'll switch your class. And I walked outside, I sat on the steps, and I said, this is a sign from God. I am not supposed to be in school. I'm too dumb. No. So I went home and I told my parents I wasn't going to go to school, and my mom cried a lot and my dad was mad. And then about a week and a half later, they said, right, well, you're not going to stay here on the family farm and like pretend to run a business because you don't know what you're doing. So you're going to go away. So they sent me away to be a working student with Peter and Paul, Peter Graham, Paul Delbrook. And
was Mary there?
No, but apparently they did actually have on their answering machine at one point, this is Peter and Paul, Mary's not here.
That's good.
Yeah. So I worked for them for, I guess, 3-4 years. And then from there sort of worked part-time in the winters with them.
And that was always in Canada?
No, so we would spend the summers in Canada and then the winters down in Ocala. Okay. And so I've been in Ocala for the winters since 96, and then we moved there full time in 2000.
I was 9 in 96.
Yeah, well, you know what? You know what? You'll be lucky if you're still alive when you're as old as me.
The way you ride on.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah, so I did that for a while, and then we ended up going back to Wisconsin when Jen and I, we weren't quite married yet. It was very scandalous. But we went back to Wisconsin after, I guess, maybe 4 or 5 years of working with and for Peter and Paul. And we set up a business that was based in Wisconsin in the summers and Florida in the winters. We did that for, I guess, a year or two.
So Jen, was it, you met her in Canada?
Well, funny story that. So I have this issue where I have to always be in relationships, which is, as I look back on it, kind of depressing because I probably lost out on some fun, but at least that's what Jen tries to tell me.
Serial monogamous.
Yeah. So I was actually, believe it or not, and this is embarrassing, I was engaged right fresh out of high school to another girl.
Oh my heavens.
I know. She's actually a very nice girl. I still, you know, talk to her every once in a great while and whatever, but she kind of broke up with me a little bit before I left, but because I was sort of a clingy, pathetic kind of guy.
You're heartbroken.
She wouldn't really call it off until I moved out completely. And then about a month and a half after I was at Peter and Paul's, I got a Dear John letter, literally.
Oh, no.
Officially breaking up with me during a 3-day event at the farm I was staying at, which I won because I deal well under pressure.
Wow.
Yeah. And so apparently I actually met Jen at a party that night, but I was so heartbroken that I don't really remember it.
Because you were heartbroken, you don't remember
it? I might have drank my worries away. That might be why as well. But then she moved down to Florida to work for Peter on the same farm. And actually, funny enough, I sort of laugh about it. Like, we have beaten all the statistics and odds because we lived together before we ever even started dating, because we lived in the same house. It was like communal living. And I remember Jen showed up, and Peter is really particular about his lawn. Like, you can't look at Peter's lawn the wrong way, or he knows, and he gets really upset. So Jen drove in her horse trailer, and Peter wanted me to make sure she knew where to park the trailer. He was gone for the day. And so she drove in and was starting to like back the trailer into place, and it had to go in the grass, which was fine. He told me where to go, but I could tell she was going to like start driving in the wrong areas and potentially scrape some of the grass up because she had to back up a bit of hill. And I thought to myself, I think I'm more scared of her than I am Peter. I'm going to let her back it up. I'm not going to patronize her. And so that was probably a good call, or we never would have got together.
Yeah. One choice.
Yeah. Totally. So, yeah. So that's kind of how I got into it and got to Florida.
And now you guys have Caden, who's 12, I think he's
in. Yeah, he's 12 years old. He's a ton of fun. He's a great kid. He's kind of a wise acre, I guess is what I'm allowed to say here. But he's a good kid. He's kind of an old soul. He was, like, born 40.
Yeah. And you're forcing him to ride now as well.
Well, so here's the thing. So he actually rode a bit. He had a couple ponies. I potentially was not the best coach for him as a young kid because I had him put him on one of my horses and he fell off. And, and then he got him a pony and decided that it'd be safer if he rode Western. And then the pony spooked and he whacked his nose and got a nosebleed from that. So he had a bit of a rough start, which I have to say, anybody doesn't want your kids to ride, send them to me. But then, quite honestly, when the pandemic came, he couldn't go do baseball anymore. He couldn't go see his friends as much. And so we were like, well, we got to do something. And so he started wanting to ride. And so he was riding one of my horses, Pioneer Archibald, Archie, who is a great horse. He's actually my mother-in-law's horse, and he's super quiet and good. But when he's not, he's really not. And trying to be a better person, I realized this. And Caden was starting to say, like, I want to learn to canter. And he would trot Archie around on the buckle, and Archie was perfect. But I knew if we started to canter,
It might not be.
So we had to go find a pony. So we actually have a really good friend, Chris Lees, who lives down in Gurnee area. And she had a pony that her daughter had outgrown. And so we got the pony from her, and now he's riding 2-3 days a week.
Oh, that's great. Fun.
And he basically bolts around the property and gallops off. And he's discovered that if you walk the pony all the way out to the back corner of the property and then turn it towards the barn and kick it, it will gallop as fast as it can all the way back up. And then he canters by and is like, I didn't mean to go this fast as he's running off. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, totally. Trying to stop.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
You could send him to hang out with Mike. I saw Mike likes to gallop around.
Yes. They're kind of kindred spirits, actually. Yeah.
So what are you guys doing right now with COVID and everything and horse showing and teaching and clinics? Are you pretty active or?
So actually this would be the first flight and clinic that I've gone on since this all hit.
Hopefully you don't get COVID
here. Yeah. I mean, if I do, we know where it comes from. I'm coming for you.
Bringing it back to Florida.
Yeah, that's right. Cause we don't have enough there.
Yeah. Where else would you get it?
Oh man. Yeah. Wouldn't that be ironic if I leave Florida and get it here?
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, we've been actually getting back to normal. When it first sort of everything got shut down, I think, like everybody, we were, like, closed down and there was no money coming in. And it was, you know, you're sort of – I honestly, at the time, I was like, well, this is actually kind of like a nice forced vacation. Mm-hmm. But then I started seeing the bank account was getting smaller and smaller. It's like, at some point, I'm going to have to go back to work. Yeah, I'm not ready to retire yet. So when we were allowed, we started opening things back up. And we have protocol at home, like – I had to build a wash stall for everybody that's further away, and there's sanitizing stuff that we do, and people can't come in the barns and stuff like that. But all of that's getting a little more relaxed as we go, which, again, I think is really funny in Florida that anything would be getting relaxed right now, but, you know, whatever.
It's Florida.
It's Florida. So we have been to a couple of schooling events. We certainly could have gone to some recognized horse shows, but I have a group of horses that I'm trying to take to an autumn CCI long. And hopefully it's going to be in November. I know Jockey Club got canceled. But I have on very good authority there will be an event picking up that date. And so with that in mind, the way I always work it is I start with where I want to finish my season and then work my way back. So my horses all ran mid-July at the Florida Horse Park because although it was a schooling event, there was a proper cross-country course that was set up from the March horse trials.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
So they all ran there. As far as they're concerned, they all had an official event.
Yeah.
And then they're going to go out in about 2 weeks' time again, and they'll move up a level and run there. And then we're really like every 2 weeks until Thanksgiving.
Cool.
How do you condition your horses for the long format?
So we do a lot of trotting. And we actually have access to a few hills in Ocala now. So it used to be when we didn't have access to places with hills, we would do like our old school gallop sets where, you know, we go up, we trot for 15, 20 minutes and then do three sets of whatever, four, five, six or sevens. We'd do that once a week and trot midweek. Now that we have access to some great places with hills, we still do our trots, but we'll gallop less time. So I try to gallop sort of every 5, 6, or 7 days, depending on how far into the season we are. And so we'll do the hill work, and it's nice because then we can do a little less time actually galloping because we're going up the hills. So where I used to be doing like, you know, 3 sets of 7-minute canters, I can now do like 3 times up the hill at like 2.5 minutes, and they're pretty fit.
Yeah.
And then that's nice. If I need a little bit more, we're really lucky in Ocala. We've got you know, aqua treads and mm-hmm. swimming pools, and I have certainly utilized that a lot in the past.
Those are so cool.
They are pretty neat. They're a little scary. I had one, tell you what, we had a place we used to take the horses to swim, and I've had two. I had one horse, they were both not my horses, I was doing them for a friend, and this one horse, it was an advanced horse, it actually went to Kentucky to the 5-star after this. It was swimming, and it always had a little bit of a funny back, and all of a sudden, the whole back end of the horse started twisting around, and I could see the bottoms of its feet as it was, like, twisting itself around, trying to swim itself out of the pool, and I remember I was alone.
Scary.
Because I was an idiot. And I've got this horse on a lead rope, and, like, they give you a wooden pole to keep it off the wall. Like, yeah. You clip the pole to the bottom of the halter. And I'm pulling this horse, trying to, like, pull him out of the pool. And I'm watching the halter, like, pull up behind his ear. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. How am I going to explain this if this horse drowns? And what do you do if a horse drowns in a pool? Yeah. Like, how do you get it out?
Like,
it was scary.
Can you give them CPR?
You'd have to jump a lot.
Yeah.
So fortunately, it all turned out fine, and I learned my lesson. I was in my 20s. I learned my lesson. Don't swim a horse alone. Right?
Hey,
that's pretty dumb. And then I had another one that just was nervous about it, and, you know, again, I was young, and you're sort of like, everybody was young with horses, getting a little bit probably less patient than I should have been, and it got nervous and slipped coming out of the pool and fell over, and that was nerve-wracking as well. So
yeah.
You got to be careful when you do that stuff and make sure you have people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, for sure.
I kind of learned it the hard way.
Have you ever heard, like, I feel like when we were younger, people would be like, don't take your horses swimming because they'll never want to go in a water jump again. Have you ever heard of that?
No, you know what? Actually, funny enough, my first horse that I ever evented was really funny about water, and I was worried about that. But I also needed to get him fit, and we were in Florida, so I did it, and he actually got better.
Cool. Got used to the water.
Yeah, he sort of understood, like, oh, well, this is deeper water, and he understood, like, the ramp. I think if you took them and, like, ran them off the edge and jumped them into the pool and they,
like,
sunk.
Like, wild hearts can't be broken.
Right,
that's
yeah.
Classic. I think,
don't do that sport.
No, I doubt it.
I can't believe they
would be all over that.
I can't believe they ever did that.
Yeah, that's insane.
They might, but no, I think if you, like, jumped them into a pool, that might...
Yeah.
Be a problem. But the way they do it at swimming, like proper horse swimming pools, is there's a ramp. And
yeah.
So I think they actually learn to, I think they, you know, it's like people. People
like
that are scared of swimming are scared of water because people who are scared of water are scared of it because they can't swim.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think once the horse understands, again, I only have the one experience with one who was bad about water going into it, but he actually did get better.
And when they actually do swimming, they're galloping, right? Like, that's what their motion is?
Yeah, I guess. That's a good question. I'm not an expert on that.
I think so.
I think it's
a gallop.
It kind of looks like it. You know that it'd be Ronald Zavala. He's really into that.
Can they change leads in the water?
I mean, I guess if you change directions.
They probably lead
with
one leg.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be probably, like, somebody listening probably knows better than I do, but...
Let us know, everyone.
Yeah. Send it in, guys. But it's really good, actually, the swimming. It gives them a big breath of air. Like, they really take big breaths and really work quite hard. You have to be a little careful because they make them a little back sore if you introduce it too quickly.
Yeah. What about developing incorrect muscles? Because they have to...
I think if all you did was swim them, yes.
Yeah.
If you work them regularly and round and deep and do your proper work, then you're going there basically to get their wind.
Well, and isn't that a little bit why the aqua tread was invented, too? So that you could have your horse... not fully submerged in the water, but you still get, like, the resistance. And
yeah, so the way I always look at it, and, you know, it's only sort of my theory with it is... So it's correct.
It's the only theory.
Because it's mine. Yeah, exactly. I will tread horses to replace trotting.
Yep.
And I will swim horses to replace galloping.
Yep, okay.
So if
so
you need...
it's primarily about cardiovascular
fitness. Yes, you're not going to...
without pounding their legs.
Correct. Yeah. So, like, my downtown Harrison horse was... not the most sound horse in the world, and I probably would have lost the last 3, if not 4 years of his career if I hadn't swam him. And he got to the point his last 2 years, all he did was aqua tread and swim. That was the only fitness work he did, because if I did more than that, he just couldn't hold up to it. And it worked great, and he's retired, well, semi-retired now, he's Jen's horse. But because of that, he's sound and happy and doing everything he should do. I just had to be smart about it. And that's the thing, like, so often you get asked, like, what should we do? What's your fitness program? What should I do with my horse?
Right.
And it's so based on, one, obviously, where you live and what you have available. And then, two, what's the horse need?
Right.
You know, like, you have a thoroughbred horse, probably doesn't need to gallop near as much as a big, heavy, warm blood horse.
Right.
You gotta sort of, it's just like people. It's very personalized or horse-analyzed.
Yeah. So, what horses do you have right now?
So I've got a really good group. So I've got, and I did not name him, I've got a horse named Douchey Terma. And he's amazing. I know, it's
a
horse.
He's not a douche.
He's not a douche. He is, you know what? He's kind of a douche. But he's a really nice horse. He's a Dutch bred horse. And I'm super lucky. He's owned by Team Rebecca and my mom, actually.
Okay.
Funny enough. Mm-hmm. So they own him, and he's going advanced and is a super nice horse. And then I've got a Tricaner bred horse who was actually bred in Florida, which is kind of fun. Named Prophet, and he's super. He's going 3-star, and maybe I might. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag here. I might, if I everything lines up right, let him run one advance this year. But the plan is to take him to a 3-star long.
That's nice. You just allow him to do that.
Yeah, I might let him. I might let him. To be honest, I'm more worried about showing him the flying changes in the massage test. Because we worked on those a little bit, and it definitely messed with the simple changes.
Oh, no.
But whatever. We'll see. Yeah. And then I've got Caden's old horse, Pioneer Archibald.
Okay.
And he's just moved up to intermediate. And hopefully, if things go well, the plan would be to do a 3-star long with him.
Nice.
And then I was actually really fortunate to get a group of people together to buy a thoroughbred off the track that we got through the Secretariat Center in Lexington.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Dorothy Crowell actually set me up with him and found him for me. His name's Ragtime Rebel, and I occasionally put out stuff on Eventing Nation and little post about him.
Yeah, I feel like I saw him maybe on the
Do you want to know something really? You want to know something super embarrassing? So I put those videos together and sent them out because that was part of the deal when I bought the horse from the centers. They wanted a bit of a promotional thing out of it as well. Like,
sure.
They have this all-star program where they want upper-level riders to produce these horses. And I do truly love this horse. He's really nice. And it's such a good feeling sitting on a thoroughbred leaving the start box.
Yeah.
So I put together these videos. So somehow I put together this little promotional video to send out on Facebook and send to Eventing Nation, hope that they would be kind enough to share it. And I use my phone as my office, right? Mm-hmm. As a horse person, my phone is my office. So it's always on me.
Yeah.
And I'm riding. And when I get done riding, I pick up my phone and I always check my messages in between horses while I'm hacking out. So I'm checking my messages and I look down and I'm like, you know, that sinking feeling. You're like, oh, I cannot believe that just happened.
Yep.
I sent out the promotional video to all of my peers in Florida. Like, Sinead got it. Clayton got it. David got it. Everybody. There was like a chat group on my Facebook page. Everybody got this. And it was like, hey guys, check out my video. And I'm like, oh my God. And there must have been like 30 to 40 of the most well-respected event people in the Southeast.
Did anyone reply?
I got a couple like, huh? Question marks and like a funny face. Yeah. And immediately I sent back. I'm like, I'm really sorry, everybody. I don't know why that
just
went.
Ignore
that last one. I'm really not this much of a jerk, but I am. So it's fine.
Check out my cute horse gang.
I only like to send it out to the entire world, not just to a select group of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was funny.
That's really funny. I think I saw him on their website, though. I was perusing it a few months back
and
noticed him.
Yeah, he's a nice horse.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, so those are sort of my top 4 horses. Then I got some other ones that are coming on and doing their thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Is there one facet of kind of the sport that you like the most? Like teaching, clinics, riding, showing?
You know, it's interesting. I think
Podcasting.
Coming on this show. Love Unstable and Unbridled. That's my hobby. So I would have told you that, like, before this pandemic hit, and I think, you know, you have to make lemonade out of lemons, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all sort of stuck not doing as much there for a while. And before that hit, I would have told you that I only would ride and do what I'm doing because I love to compete. And when I wasn't allowed to compete, the one thing I wanted to keep doing was ride. And it was really nice because it sort of almost refreshed me a little bit to be like, oh wow, like I actually do this because I love riding horses and love working with the horses. So to be honest, if I had all the money in the world, like I love I do love to teach, but I love to teach where it's like, I can teach the people, like anything, you want to do what you want to do.
Right.
I want to teach people who really want to learn,
right.
who really want to be a part of it.
You would be a little pickier with me.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be picky. And I wouldn't teach, like, in the winter in Florida, you're teaching everybody you can because you're trying to make the money for the year. Yeah.
Right.
If I had all the money in the world and didn't have to worry about making money, I think I would probably ride between 4 and 5 horses a day at most. They'd be the best 4 or 5. Yeah. And I'd probably teach 2 or 3 people a day at most, and I'd be done.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I love to do.
10 to 2.
Yeah. Oh, be great. I wouldn't even mind 7 to 11. But,
especially in the summer.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I think, you know, Kyle Carter and I joke a little bit with each other, and one of the things that we occasionally will say to each other is, like, the thing with being a professional in the equestrian world is you take something that you grew up loving to do and you make it into a career and you do it every day for the rest of your life until you can't stand it.
Who wants to be a horse trainer?
But I think that's probably the reality in any job, right? It's tough to have to go to work and do the same thing every day sometimes. But at the same point, I think you do have to step back and not just with horse jobs, but step back and realize, like, how lucky you are that you have a job and that you are able to make a living. And I do love what I do. I think sometimes you get a little burnt out, and especially living where I live, where it's a bit seasonal. So, like, from January to April, it's insane. And that's great. We're busy. But sometimes I think you forget when you get up in the morning, you're like, oh, I got to rush through my horses so that I can get done with them, so that I can teach these 8 people this afternoon so that they don't get upset. And then, you know, you double book somebody, so now you're panicked because you're like, oh, why is this trailer pulling? And you just get a little
bad.
Yeah, you get a little bit overwhelmed. And I think the one thing that I've learned sort of in these last few months dealing with the pandemic is you have to step back sometimes and make a little time for yourself and take a break, like a forced break, so that you realize what you're doing every day is actually a privilege.
Yeah. I think a lot of people felt that way about the pandemic. It gave people time to reflect on what they were doing and exactly why they were doing it. And I've seen a few articles, I feel like, recently come out about people saying it was nice to have the transition away from the next clinic or the next show back to just the day-to-day.
Totally. And I think for myself anyway, it's nobody's fault but my own. Like, it's self-imposed. I could say to people, you know what, actually, I'm sorry, I don't have time.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were joking before we came on air that I'm like the guy who can't say no. And so sometimes I feel like if somebody asks me for help, like, okay, I got to do it. You know, and I think it's okay. What I've realized now is it's okay to say to somebody, like, look, I'd love to, but actually I'm slammed.
Right.
Yeah. What's your favorite part
of life or horsing?
Horsing.
Like, well, we're adding magic, obviously. My very own little precious animal.
So riding in general?
Yeah, like, riding.
Yeah, I would say, like, if I could, I would take lessons every day.
Yeah.
I would be a lessoner. Like, last night, I rode all my horses with John when he got in, and it was just fun. Like, my mom was here, and I was like, I could do this every day. You know, Maura was there helping. Janie was helping. A couple other people came to watch and help, too. And
it helps when they're nice horses, too. That
True. Yes. And it was just fun. Lessons back to back. And today, you're riding all my horses, which is extremely helpful. And I could do this all the time.
Yeah,
it's fun. Absolutely.
I do love to compete, though. I'm really competitive, so I like to show. But
yeah.
So, with showing, do you have something in your entire career that you would consider your biggest accomplishment?
Oh, man.
Or a favorite memory?
You know what? I've been in this sport for a very long time. So, to be fair, there's probably 2 or 3, but I would say probably my favorite biggest accomplishment was I took a horse named Direct Merger to Kentucky to jump around the 5-star in like 2006 or seven. And he was notoriously a very difficult horse. He wasn't great on the flat. He was very Irish. And he had a neck that was made of, we can get into that.
You haven't heard our Irish theory. Probably.
I have.
Oh, you have?
I have heard your Irish theory.
Oh,
we can get into that. Yes. Yes. So he had a very hyper-flexible neck. We sort of always joked that he had anal neck fasciitis. Because if you pulled on the reins at all, he would stick his head straight back to his chest so far that eventually it would come out his butthole. Which made doing the dressage, or truthfully any real good collection work, incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
But I got him to Kentucky. He put in, for him, a good test. For everybody else, probably a slightly below average test. And then he proceeded to go out and jump a double clear cross-country round. And it was the one and only time the horse ever made time cross-country, because finally the fences were big enough that I was able to let go and let him take me to the jumps. Yeah. He was so incredibly brave. And then, actually, funny story. I can tell this now because it's been enough years. I can tell it publicly. I rode my other horse, Lion King, who I thought was going to be a contender to go to wherever we were going that year, Pan Ams or whatever, and they decided, well, they didn't decide. I decided by riding badly on that horse that he wasn't going. So I figured that, you know, they would at least take the direct merger horse, the team, the USEF, would want to, like, see him and jog him up the next day and take a look at him. And so typically in those days what happened was you jog your horse on Sunday morning, and if it passed the inspection to go on to show jumping, then one of the selectors or the team manager for the eventing team would come up to you and say, hey, we saw your horse go, we really liked him, we'd love to have you stick around after the event and have him looked at by the vets for evaluation to go, I think it was to Rio for the Pan Ams.
Cool.
And they didn't. I walked right by them. They wouldn't even make eye contact with me.
I'm here. You guys walked past me.
Yeah. So this will be a little insight into the kind of person I am. I went around looking for the head selector, Peter Green, who actually, funny enough, I bought the horse through. And I couldn't find him. And he's a friend of mine. I haven't seen him, and actually he's sort of retired from horses now, so I haven't seen him in a long time, but he is a really nice guy. That's a lie. Peter, sorry if you're listening. You're actually kind of a jerk, but but I really like Peter. He's just an aggressive guy. So I say that lovingly. But I couldn't find him. So finally I was like, forget this. So before show jumping started, I called him. And I said, what's the deal? You didn't want to see my horse jog? He jumped around double clear yesterday. It was a huge track. You guys should want him. And he said, probably correctly, look, we don't think the dressage is good enough. And you're probably another year or two off with him. So just keep working on it. And we'll, you know, see you next time. And I said, yeah, well, you guys are idiots. He's going to show jump double clear today. And you're going to look like a moron. You should have taken him. And I hung up the phone. And then I was like, oh, God, what did I just do?
Yeah.
So I went into show jumping, completely panicked that I was going to make a mess of it. And so I did my old count your way around the course, one, two, one, two.
You don't normally do that? I do.
I do it in my head, but this one I actually said out loud because I was like, I'm going to make a mess of this. And so I went in and he show jumped clear. I did have 3 time penalties, so I wasn't quite right.
No.
And then because I was so pumped at how good I was, I looked up into the crowd and I found him and I gave him the old fist pump with like a snarl, and they still didn't want the horse, so it didn't matter. But the conclusion of that story is I ended up finishing 7th at Kentucky on him, on a horse that was incredibly difficult. I finished right ahead of Ian Stark and Mary King.
Nice.
I got to talk to them, which was like 2 of my childhood heroes.
Yeah.
And I've told them both the story, and both of them don't seem impressed that that is like my highlight. But, you know, it was pretty cool. So, yeah, I mean, that's probably the biggest one. And then, of course, you know, I won Red Hills 1 year on my Lion King horse, and then I won Bromont on my Downtown Harrison horse, both in the 4 stars. So those were pretty good ones as well.
Yeah. I'd say that's a nice laundry list.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay. We're not done yet. My biggest highlight has not yet happened. Yeah.
Yet to come.
Is there... So you obviously do clinics since you're here now.
Yep.
Clinicking with us. We've kind of asked every clinician, what's your favorite part about clinicking and what's your least favorite part or pet peeves that you have?
I mean, my favorite part about clinics are that you get to go... usually see new places, meet new people, and sort of, you know, it's a little bit good for your ego as well. I'm not going to lie to you.
Like, you want me?
You get, yeah, I mean, I think that's probably something that people don't really talk about. But, like, as a kid growing up, all I wanted to do was make enough money riding horses that I could have one good horse to ride and compete, and that was like, that was my dream. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in Wisconsin thinking I was gonna, you know,
have multiple nice horses.
Yeah, like ride around Kentucky several times and go to Europe to compete. I just wanted to have a nice horse and be able to afford it. And so now looking back on it, and I think this is a little bit what I was trying to allude to with this whole forced break we were on, is I think sometimes you have to look back and be like, okay, so when I was 19, what did I think I was going to accomplish and what have I done? Mm-hmm. And I think if you had told me at 19 that I would get to fly across the country to teach clinics in places like Copeland Farms and teach great riders and great horses clinics, I would have told you, well, that's not going to happen. So it is, I mean, it is nice to go someplace and have people that are genuinely there who are there because they want your help. And conversely, my pet peeve would be when you have someone at one of those clinics or even when they show up at your lessons and they're so obviously not there to learn.
Right.
They're there. And that doesn't happen often, but it does happen occasionally where you get somebody, whether it's a kid who's kind of being forced into it by their parents. Or sometimes you do get, like, an adult amateur who a little bit has showed up to the clinic because they want to show off.
Yeah.
And when you start trying to help them through stuff, they are resistant. And that is difficult for me because I kind of think to myself, well, then why are we doing this? Like, we don't have to
jump small fences and be told we're the best.
Right. Well, I mean, and fair enough. I like that, too. But I don't know. I just think... If I had one thing as far as a clinic, that, I mean, truthfully, that's probably the only one.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have, it's probably in my entire career of clinic, in which is, as Liz pointed out, been a very long time because I'm super, super old.
I've clinics with you since, what do we say, 2005?
Yeah. You were 30 then, right?
Yeah.
So it's been a long time, and it's probably, I've only had, you know, I could count them on one hand. But when it does happen, it's frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd have a hard time with that if I... And, I mean, trying to teach anyone anything, even not horse-related, when they're, like, clearly not willing to listen.
Right.
It's like, bang my head against the wall.
Yeah, it's, just, it's a bit of a personality flaw, really, I suppose. Yeah. It happens, and again, it happens in everything.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Well, we love having you up here, so keep coming back.
All right.
This is actually
I appreciate
my first time riding with you.
And how did we do?
We stayed attached to the horse. So.
All right, perfect. I thought you rode great.
Learned some stuff, practiced some leg yield, some lateral work.
Yeah.
Soften that old back up.
That's right.
Good stuff.
That's right, and the horses too.
Yep.
Yeah.
So back to our Irish theory.
Yeah,
what are your thoughts?
Say more about that.
Okay, so here's my theory on it. I think, in general, Ireland produces horses to sell.
Yes.
They always sell their best horses. And some of the best horses I've had have been Irish horses. But when you buy, and I think Lillian was the one who agreed with this a little bit, when you buy a young Irish horse, it is not trained to the age that it actually is.
Right.
It is all it knows how to do, if it's under the age of six for sure, is canter, probably in a small mud paddock, to a very big fence one time to show off what a good jumper it is. And that's not through any fault of the Irish. They're just producing horses to sell. I mean, I've gone to look at horses there several times, and I'm not making this up. Every single time I've gone, I go through immigration, they look at my passport, and they say, oh, welcome to Ireland, what are you here for? And that's a really bad Irish accent. And I say...
I'm impressed.
Yeah,
and,
that's good.
And I tell them, oh, I'm here to look at horses. And he goes, oh, great. My brother-in-law, he's got a horse down the road in a paddock. Would you like to go and see him? I'll give you his number. And I'm like, if I say no, I'm probably not getting in, so yes, please. And every time, the immigration officer will give me the phone number of some member of his family who's got a horse down in the field that he wants me to see. And so then I go and throw the number away usually because I don't have time to look at it. But it's a culture of producing these horses to sell. And it's, instead of if you buy horses... in England, and I'm sure some of my Irish friends are going to be really upset with me for saying this, you buy horses in England, those are typically horses that have been trained to compete, and possibly some to compete to sell, but they've been trained more to go do stuff. So I always tell people, if you want to find a really well-bred horse that is meant to event and you want to buy it to produce it, you go to Ireland. Because that's where they are and that's going to be the best price. If you want to buy something that's started and that you can sort of get here and kick on with right away, then you want to go to England, maybe into mainland Europe. I haven't done Europe that much. But as far as Ireland and England, that would be the difference to me is I don't think it's that the Irish horses are crazy or difficult or whatever. Some of them are, some of them aren't. It's just that they haven't been...
It's nurture versus nature.
Well, a little bit. I just think they typically haven't been produced to compete and been produced to sell.
Yeah. So, but you say you have some American bred horses right now, right?
Yep. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on American bred horses?
I love American bred horses. So here's the deal. If I'm going to go take a client to find a horse and it can financially work for them, I would much rather go to England or Ireland or Europe to find them a horse because I can see at least 10 to 20 times more horses in the same amount of time. So I can go over to England with my friend Mike Winter and he can help me set up a trip and I can show myself or my clients in 2 days probably close to 15 to 20 quality horses that all match the criteria of whatever it is we're looking for. To do that here in the States, those same horses exist here, except for two things. One, Americans, as professionals, don't sell their horses, right? Because if they want them sold, then they put crazy prices on them because they don't really want them sold. Not looking at anyone. Or they're all spread out.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, I've gone to look for horses before and had to fly literally from Wisconsin to Seattle to New York to Dallas to Southern California to Florida, and you see one or two horses at best in each location. So it's actually, if you're looking for one particular type of horse, it's far cheaper
to go
over there and find them all rather than buying all these multiple plane tickets to make these big trips all over North America.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but that does make sense.
Yeah, so you have to obviously factor the transporting the horse back to the U.S., but if you find a horse you love here, then this is the place to do it, and you find it, and I think right now you don't have a choice anyway, right?
Yeah.
But if you're going to just actually sit down and put pen to paper and do the math, it, time-wise and money-wise, it isn't that much more expensive to go to Europe, and in some cases, if you don't find it right away over here, it's probably cheaper.
Yeah. Horse shopping sounds hard.
I love horse shopping.
I really like it with other people's money. But
yeah, well, that's always the best way to do it, for sure.
I've never gone horse shopping for myself.
Me either.
I've gone horse shopping lots for other people.
Oh, you should totally try it. I'll take you.
No, I'm good.
It'll be fun.
She seems to do a good enough job getting a hold of her horses.
Yeah, you seem to always have good horses. But
I'm just going
to
make them now. That's what I'm on now, is just breeding them.
But you're still also buying them, so I think you've just added a leg to them.
I mean, I haven't bought a horse in at least 6 months, so.
In 6 months.
Yeah. So you are involved a lot with the safety committees with USEA and USEF. Why don't you tell us a little more about your role there and the collapsible fences and the frangible pins and the fundraisers and all of that?
Okay. So I'm the chair of the cross-country safety subcommittee. I think it's still subcommittee. It might be committee. For the USEA. And so that is a really good group of people, very intelligent. We've got some horsemen on there, some event riders, we've got course designers, we've got a couple engineers. And so what that group does is we always try to look at being very proactive with how we can improve safety in the sport. And the goal with safety and eventing is not to eliminate the risk, because that's just an inherent part of it, but it's to try to minimize the risk as much as we can. And so that group has been an incredibly active group. And honestly, like, I'm a big believer in this, and I say it jokingly a lot, but I think it's good advice for anybody who has to lead these committees. You want to always surround yourself with people who are smarter than you.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And I think that's probably a good goal in life.
Yeah.
You never want to carry the coffin alone. So
right, right. And so my job is actually just to be a bit of a facilitator and try to get everybody together and get them talking. And that group has been amazing with some of the stuff that they've come up with as far as changing some rules around, making recommendations to the sport, stuff like that, and all stuff that you guys have seen come out of the USEA.
Which you did in a, you rallied the troops in a very interesting way, I think, with some ink.
Yes, correct? Yes. So I think one of the things, just on that note, is when you're the chairman, when you're not even the chairman, when you're a member of a safety committee with the USEF, one of the sad things that you have to do is look at all the accidents that happen in the sport. Mm-hmm. And along with that, without getting into any of the details, you have to watch a lot of videos of things that go wrong. And over time, that gets to you. And not like, it gets to different people different ways. Mm-hmm. For me, it gets to me that I feel very responsible about things that probably aren't my responsibility necessarily. But it hits you hard. Yeah. It really does. And that's not like to like, you know, poor me type of thing, but it does. It really, you feel vested in it. You feel responsible for it. And you feel like you have to do something. You have to do something. Right. And to be honest, in that respect, it's probably quite selfish because you're doing some of this stuff just to ease your own conscience. And so you have to be careful about, like, are these actually good decisions you're trying to make, or are you doing it just to make yourself able to sleep at night?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we had the accident at Rocking Horse this spring and Kat Morrell hit the table on cross country, mm-hmm. I remember sitting in my truck. It was actually the next day, waiting to go out to cross country warm up some of my students. And I just decided at that point, like, I can't deal with this anymore. Like, we have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the ability to have these frangible fences out on course, and they aren't out there because they're expensive.
Right.
And that seems like a really bad
reason
not to have them, right?
Yeah.
So I just, without really discussing it too much with anybody, put out the challenge to everybody to raise the money.
Mm-hmm.
And then fortunately, the cross-country safety subcommittee stepped up and said, yeah, we think this is a good idea, and so did the USEA. And then actually Andy Bowles, who's a organizer and an official, said, I 100% agree with you, and he organized the GoFundMe group, and now he chairs a group for the USEA that I'm on as well, that is actually in charge of how that money is getting spent and how it's going out. And so we've raised a bunch of money for that, but we got probably to around the $200,000 mark very quickly. It was amazing.
It's amazing.
And then things kind of stalled because COVID hit.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was understandable. And in some ways, I have felt a little guilty as people are like not getting work, not getting paychecks to like still be trying to fundraise. But I think it's important as we think about horses and riders going back out on cross country that we're still trying to make things safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking with Rick Wallace on the phone, sitting with my dog, having a beer beside the pool. And I was like, I don't know what we're going to do. Like, it's just, we're just not raising money. Like, we're just gonna have to wait this out. And Rick was like, well, tell him you'll get a tattoo. And I was like,
didn't you shave your head too once for Young Riders?
I like doing stupid stuff. Yeah. It's kind of fun. So I was like, well, that's a really bad idea. I'm going to do that. And so I put a little video together and said I'd go get a tattoo if we could raise $50,000. It started out at 10, and I was like, well, that seems too easy.
Yeah.
Let's go to 25, and then Rick was like, well, just go 50.
Yeah.
Just go 50. So I'm like, okay, we'll go 50, because every $50,000, we get a matching grant from the Manton Foundation. And so I was like, 50 makes sense, and there's no way we'll get to 50.
Yeah, so we'll never have to get a tattoo.
Yeah. So I said, yep, all right, $50,000 before the first horse leaves the start box on cross country. And I sort of envisioned like making a video the morning of and be like, hey guys, we're like $5,000 short.
Right.
The first horse starts here at 10 o'clock. We got to get this money in, and like pushing it right to the point and then not quite getting the money in. Right? You get $45,000 and away we go.
Yeah.
And sadly, it was like 10 days before we were getting to the end that Rob Burke called me up, and I say sadly, but actually it's amazing.
Yeah.
Rob Burke from USEA called me up and he said, well, you better get ready to go get the ink because it happened. And I'm like, oh man, you gotta be kidding me. So yeah, so we did it, and yeah, I got a little YouTube video out or whatever.
I listened to it, but I haven't actually seen the video yet, so I'll have
it's not as good as I had hoped, because one of the points of it was I wanted everybody to see the pain in my face, yeah. but I had to have a mask on.
Oh.
So I have like one of those pull-up masks, yeah. and it was black, yeah. and it was like right, you know, obviously right below my eyes. So all you can sort of see is my eyes up gets red.
Yeah.
really red, really fast. But it was just, you know, the little hashtag Frangible Now tattoo. I think it yeah. took a grand total of 4.5 minutes, and it certainly was the most expensive, shortest tattoo I've ever gotten.
Will you share a photo of us with it? Or
a photo of you with it? Yeah, you want to, let's get a photo of you with my tattoo.
Share a photo of your tattoo with us
yes.
so that we can post it on the
yes, I will. I've got it. I've got it right here. You guys heard it. They want a picture of me with my shirt off. Don't
this
tell,
isn't that kind of podcast.
Don't tell Jen.
why do you think the accident this spring was like the turning point? Was it just the way it happened, or was it just the sheer amount of accidents that have happened, or like what do you think was kind of the driving force behind really making changes?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it's actually one of the first ones in the last couple of years that's happened in competition. Mm-hmm. So we had some bad accidents in North America anyway. We had some bad accidents the last couple of years, but you know, one was at home with somebody training. One was in the warm up.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, maybe that's a bit of a lame answer because we certainly have had them in yeah. competition as mm-hmm. well. I think the thing is, every time something like this happens, you want to feel like you're going to do something to make it better, right? And I think every time every time there's been an accident that I've been involved with the federation or the association, I've done what I think we're able to do or encouraged people to do what I think the federation and the association are able to do to make things safer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when this happened, the technology now exists that we could take that fence and make it safer.
Yeah. Right.
And we hadn't been. So I think for me, that was the difference is we've had accidents at fences that could be friendly. Like, so Darren Chacha in, 2008 had his bad accident at Red Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of fence is able to be frangible and made more safe. And it actually did happen after that.
Yeah.
So, you know, there wasn't maybe as much publicity around it, but things did change right after. We had the whole safety summit and all of that right after that. So something happened after that. I lost a horse that day, another rider lost a horse that day, and then Darren got seriously hurt. And so there was a safety summit. A lot of things changed,
mm-hmm.
right? So I don't know that this is any more change. It might be less than what we did then.
It's just available. More,
it's just yeah. now more we broad. Have these frangible tables that can, they're not going to save everybody's life. And one of my biggest fears is I don't want to go out on cross country now and have, you know, 80% of the course be frangible tables.
Yeah.
That's not the idea. The idea is to replace the old tables that aren't safe with these tables and still have the same number of tables. Because tables actually are horrible cross country jumps to gallop.
Yeah.
They're fences more to be set in combinations or out of lines or, you know, you jump through the water, jump out over a table. But to gallop across a field and jump a table, there's so many better options. You can have a steeplechase brush, you know, a double brush table, things like that that are so much better. But where they're appropriate, why not make them frangible if you can?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so I think that's where, for me anyway, that's where my push came from is I sit on these committees and you hear about this stuff and you'll sit at a table with a lot of very intelligent people and they'll say, wow, yeah, you know, those tables, you know, maybe they're good, but they're so expensive. And I'm like, okay, you know what? I didn't know Kat terribly well. I didn't know her at all.
Yeah.
But I know her life was worth more than $500,000.
Right. Yeah. What would you say with the tables you just talked about being more like galloping fences? Have more of the accidents been at that have been at tables been placed as an individual fence on course?
I don't have the statistics, so I can't know. I can only kind of speculate on it. But I think my speculation is probably better than most. So one of the challenges with course design and galloping fences, particularly on flatter pieces of property, is that you don't want a long, straight approach down to something. So,
especially if it's upright.
Right. And so I think where, as a course designer, you can get into trouble, and not saying that this happened at the horse park, or sorry, at Rocking Horse at all, just saying in general, where you can get into some trouble with tables is when you plop them in the middle of the field. And just, you know, think about where you were working yesterday, Liz, cantering across the ring and jumping a single fence.
The whole arena.
Right, yeah. So now you put that in the middle of a field and gallop, you know, 200-300 yards.
Right. Faster.
As fast as you can go, right? And you try to jump that, and that can be difficult. And, you know, again, the thing is, people are going to make mistakes. I make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. Mark Todd makes mistakes. Right. But it's a little bit as well, like, I think part of me wants to help to feel like when, not if, sadly, but when the next accident happens, that we've done everything we can.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we've done everything we can, then I think you can say, right, we did our best.
Right.
And sometimes bad stuff happens.
Yeah.
And so you want to try to minimize the risk for the individuals, but also there is irresponsible riding that happens. And I also feel like part of our responsibility as horsemen and as caretakers of the sport is to protect the sport from irresponsible riding.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can say, well, the officials should stop them, the coaches should coach them better, they should ride better, and that's all true. Rider responsibility is like the number one thing to improve safety in the sport, and we have to keep working on that. But I want to protect my sport from bad riding.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes from my own bad riding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've been out on cross country and made some bad choices in the heat of the moment being aggressive and come off the course and thought, well, I got away with one there. I better not do that again.
Yeah.
Right? So I think you just, that to me, that's it. You got to protect the riders from themselves, mm-hmm. and you have to protect the sport as a whole from irresponsible riding.
Have you done a LandSafe clinic?
I have.
They're fun.
They are fun.
They're
it's
really
like,
fun. You
like
tumble around.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think my feeling with it is this. I think it's great for everybody to do. I think it makes everybody more aware of what's going on and how to get out of bad situations. I think it's best, and if we could find a way to make it mandatory for younger riders coming into the sport, because those are the ones who are learning how to do stuff. When you get older, I think sometimes it's hard to like think in the heat of the moment you're going to do something different.
Right.
Because, you know, like when I was growing up, you were always taught, like, save it to the last moment, cling on and fight to get it done. And, you know, I think sometimes that's hard to feel like, okay, now you get to the point where you should just give up on that and get out of the way.
Right.
And Danny does a great job explaining that in the LandSafe program about, like, he puts you on, he put me on the horse, on the
right, and
whatever.
Tips it over.
And tips it over. He's like, okay, tell me when you get to the point where you can't save it. And I'm like, okay, right there. And he's like, right, that's the point. When you get to there, you're not going to try to save it. You need to get out of the way, and you know that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, you know what? You're right. I do know that. And so help me. How do I save it a little bit better? But I think for a kid who doesn't have that yet, it's a great program because it probably would save them a couple of my broken legs that they don't need to have.
Broken bones.
Yeah.
Well, and even the amateurs, I think, like I had a couple, we had one here last fall, and I had some riders do it as well that really enjoyed it. And I have some riders who didn't do it because they're worried that they're going to get hurt doing it.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You'll be okay. Like,
which, to be honest, well, we can go into this now, should be a whole nother piece of this.
Right.
If you are afraid, and by the way, when I say kids, I guess I'm sort of lumping all kids and amateurs into that.
Okay.
But I think this is another thing. If you truly think that you are physically unable to get through something like a LandSafe program,
you shouldn't be on a horse.
Should you be out there galloping cross country?
Right.
And
or even riding. I mean, I think that the basis of it is, yes, for cross-country riding, or, you know, Danny used a steeplechase, but even just general riding, your horse rears. Like, they teach you the one where the horse rears,
and
jumping
step off
the back, and like...
Yeah, I just think I see so many people who ride that I think if that horse takes a footstep wrong, you're done.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
learn how to deal with that if it were to happen.
Right. It's, you know, it's about body awareness and control and all of that good stuff, and I think, you know, like, it's hard because we're taught as professionals in the sport, like, to be inclusive and everybody should get to ride and this is such a great thing. We want to share the sport with everybody. We want eventing to grow. But there's also an element of, like, look, are you actually physically strong enough and coordinated enough to go out and do this? And if you're not, like, there's still opportunities to ride, but maybe it shouldn't involve galloping as fast as you can across a field at a fence that doesn't fall down.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we should talk about our
snobbery.
That's super pretty.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Our snobbery.
Yeah.
So you got to ride my horses today, and I know you said you thought the bridles were pretty cool and you want to get one yourself.
That's not what I said. I only ride in Devoku, so.
I think it's time to go from team green to team blue.
No. I am green all the way, and it goes back to my childhood because of the Green Bay Packers.
Green and gold.
Oh.
That's right. Green and gold.
Packers people hang on to any thread.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's because we have so many Super Bowls compared to the Minnesota Vikings that, you know, we can't help but talk about
it.
Minnesota's
trash.
We have a Lizzo song, though.
Yeah, there you go.
Why don't you tell us about a lot of your coordinating tack from over the years?
Yeah, so here's the thing. I was listening to the podcast on tack, and there was a lot of, oh, that's so pretty, and I like this because of that. And it just struck me. I just thought, you know, there's a lot of people out there who maybe can't have all the
super
perfect,
pretty
super pretty stuff. And I was giving you a little bit of a hard time because I grew up riding Hunter jumpers, and part of the reason I got out of it is because the girls were so mean.
Aww.
Oh my God, I love your bracelet. Where did you get it?
Yeah, exactly. It was like
the ugliest fingers I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was like that movie Mean Girls.
Oh yeah.
But it was like my childhood life, which is why I got into eventing, actually. So when I went to Kentucky the first time to ride in the then 3, now 4-star on a horse called Prairie Schooner, who was an amazing horse, not because I couldn't have different stuff, but because it was just like, well, I'm not going to spend the money. I had a dressage saddle that I borrowed from Jen, who was my girlfriend at the time, that was used when she got it and had faded to like a really horrible olive green color.
I have one of those.
But it was a great saddle. I had a synthetic Wintec girth that was black. I had a
synthetic girths for the win.
Yeah. I had a brown double bridle that was pieced together that was actually like a brown headstall with a bradoon hanger attached to it. So it wasn't even really a real double. And then I took that headstall, took the bradoon hanger off, changed everything and put it together for my cross country bridle, which was with a different noseband that I had, I think, stolen off of somebody in the barn, and galloped around cross country on that. And
wait, what was the bit you used?
I had a Kimberwick. It was an unjointed Kimberwick with the chain and the whole deal.
Did you say this was Rolex or your D1 Raider?
Exactly my point. Okay, and so all you listeners, I have just proven my point. There is some serious snobbery here at Unstable and Unbridled.
You can go from D1 to Rolex.
Yeah, that's
all
right.
The same equipment.
That's right.
All right, in all fairness, I consider myself, like, even though I'm technically listed as a professional because I help Liz out, I very much consider myself an amateur. And I rode in the hand-me-downs that I found around the barn for many years. Now that I'm a gainfully employed adult, I have one horse, and I just want to have some nice stuff.
Yeah.
I want to have some pretty tack.
In fairness, I totally get it.
If I'm going to be going training level for life, I want to look good doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. I want to look good, too. So, yeah, no, look, I get it. I'm actually pretty snobby about what I ride in now as well. Like, all joking aside, I do only ride in the Devoku stuff, and I do think there's an element of whatever brand it is, whether it's Devoku or Antares or whatever, if you buy good quality stuff, it does last longer.
Mm-hmm.
But as well, I think if you take care of stuff, it lasts longer.
Sure.
Like, I have bridles that were old when I got them, and as Liz has said several times now, I'm really old. So I'm not. I'm really young. But those weren't all super high quality things that I had, but because we take care of them, they do hold up. And I think, you know, whatever. My point to you ladies was, if you just take care of your stuff, it doesn't matter if you have a brown saddle and a green bridle or a green saddle and a brown bridle. It, you know, you ride well and you take care of your stuff and you take care of your horses, you're going to be just fine.
Yep, that's the goal.
So when's the last time you've ridden in a not great saddle? Like, I have some saddles that we use on our lesson horses, and, like,
usually throw one of them on later when he rides someone.
Yeah, I'll put it on Armani today.
You know what?
And just the balance that it puts you in is just awful.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, like, I don't know quite what it is. It doesn't matter if it's not that they would be cheap saddles, the bad ones I've ridden in. It's usually, like, it's a very good brand, but the twist is wrong, mm-hmm. and it hits you in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I could be wrong here, that there's a difference between the type of seat a man wants to sit in between the type of seat a woman wants to
Absolutely.
Sit in. And when I get in Jen's saddles, which she's been kind enough to let me ride in right now because mine are off getting some alterations made for the horses, definitely the seat is not as comfortable as mine. And when she gets in mine, she's like, I don't know how you're riding this thing. It kills me. So I think it's more that way. I will say one of the least offensive saddles that I've ridden in at a clinic was actually a Wintec jump saddle. They're super comfy.
No kidding.
They're really grippy. And yeah, they were fine. They weren't something that I'd want to ride in necessarily every day because I think I would just tear them up.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty comfy, decent saddle to ride in. You know, obviously I'd love to be in my saddle every time, but it's hard to, you know, travel and fly with your saddle. So yeah, so it's fine. I think actually the worst thing as far as saddles go is if you ride enough horses in enough different saddles, you can usually adjust to it to like mm-hmm. get through a ride, unless it's got really slippery leather.
Oh, nothing worse.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Clean their saddles. Yeah, and it's like, I can't even sit in it.
Yeah, like you just slide right off it. Skating right. Yeah, I can't handle that.
What
yeah.
are your saddles, like your jumping saddles, do you get a specific like flap and length and forwardness?
Or? Yeah, and I would love to give you all the specific numbers of what I get, but I'm really snobby when it comes to my jump saddles. So I have to have a mono flap saddle to jump cross country, and Devoku has an amazing monoflap saddle. And I'm going to screw up all the names. I'm sorry, guys, at Devoku. I should know the names. But they make some amazing cross-country saddles. But I like to ride in... You remember the one Philip used to have that was blue?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's that model.
Okay.
And they actually don't make that model in North America. You have to special order it. Oh. And because I'm super special, I special order it.
Because you're not a snob.
Because I'm not a snob. Right. I'm not a snob. I'm just better than, you.
We'll let that stand.
Yeah. So I ride cross country in that mono flap saddle, and then I have a two flap saddle to show jump in.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a Devoku two flap saddle. It's the
Biarritz.
Yeah, and I think mine is the
Chiberta. See, doing all the Devoku things.
Chiberta would be the cross country saddle.
The Lab.
Well, yeah, but I don't ride in the Lab, so it's the Chiberta. It's not the Lab, and they swap out the flap. Because the one thing I didn't like on the Lab was I feel like there's a lot of material between me and my horse mm-hmm. and under my leg, which is great because it makes it really cushiony, but I always feel like I can't get into the horse enough.
Yeah.
I'm like the only person in North America that they sponsor that feels that way because that Lab tree is amazing.
Yeah, it's but, super cool.
Yeah, it's amazing, but I just couldn't quite convert to that, so I ride in a little bit more old school cross country saddle, and then I got the Biarritz. I think mine is the C. They do like ABC to change mm-hmm. it, and then I ride in their dressage saddle, the newest one they came out with that looks like a Martian.
The Harmony.
Is it the Harmony?
It's the Harmony. Yeah, that one.
Yeah, a Harmony. And so I'm glad that you guys are here and keep me on the straight. So I ride dressage in the Harmony, and I have to say, when they first brought it out to me, I looked at it and was like, no, that is a crazy looking saddle. I'm not going to ride in that one. And then I sat in it, and after riding around the ring for 5 minutes, I trotted, I cantered, I pulled up, and I looked at the rep and said, I need two.
Yeah.
And it
was
like, yes. It is the hands down greatest saddle I've ever ridden in my entire life. It is amazing. And so that's what I flat in, and it's been awesome.
Well, and that's what I always try to tell people. like, you just need to find what works for you mm-hmm. and what you like, because it's going to be your saddle you're sitting in. So yeah. figure it out.
Totally. And I think, you know, here's the reality is I always wanted, like, so obviously as a rider, you have sponsors and you try to be loyal to the brands that
yeah.
are loyal to you. Yeah. Right. And so I was really lucky. I had a saddle sponsor when I was like 20.
Yeah.
I just lucked into it because a friend of mine got me in touch with them. Eventually that deal came to an end and I was super lucky that I got in with Devaku and they helped me out and they've been amazing. But the reality is there's a lot of really good saddles mm-hmm. out there, a lot of really good brands. And I feel this way about a lot of stuff. I was actually just talking to a friend about tractors, lawnmowers. And I think there's a similarity between saddles and lawnmowers.
You
sit on them. If you let the horse's head down, it eats the grass, kind of like a lawnmower. Yeah. No, but they're only as good as the rep,
mm-hmm.
right?
Totally.
Absolutely.
So Devaku is amazing because they have really good reps.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure Antares, for you, Liz, mm-hmm. would be similar to you. Is like, it's a great saddle and that's wonderful, but if you don't have the people around to...
Right.
to make it right, then it's only so useful.
Right.
So to me, that's what makes the company is the people behind it.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. Well, this is probably a good time to transition into saddle sores.
I've been so excited for this.
I hope you have one prepared.
I did, but I forgot. It's a
So my saddle sore this week is when you're driving and you see dead turtles on the road. Like, I don't understand how people can't avoid hitting a turtle.
Didn't we save a turtle when we were here last time?
Yeah, it was a big snapping turtle.
And I was scared. I wouldn't get out of the car.
That's fair.
I do remember that.
That's scary.
I did find out after that, though, because I carried that turtle by its tail, that you're not supposed to do that, but... Snappers scare me a lot.
Yeah, how else are you supposed to?
You, like, grab them to the back, and you're supposed to, like, grip on their shell. But they can still scratch you, so I haven't figured it out.
And they have pretty long necks. They could reach around.
Yeah, so you're not supposed to grab them, like, on the sides, because they can bite you and obviously, like, take your finger off.
You know what? I watched you pick it up by its tail, and I think you are a hero.
He just is now paralyzed, but at least he's alive.
That's right.
And here we get the snappers. They come up from the pond, and they'll try to lay their eggs up here. So I always have this box, and I put them in the box, and then slide them back down to the pond, and then
you should just keep a box for turtles.
They usually just come back anyway.
You should keep a box for turtles in your car at
yeah,
all times.
I should.
That is a good point, though. Why can't people avoid them? It's like they're moving so
right,
fast.
Like, oh, it just ran out in front of me.
Yeah.
So yeah, save the turtles.
Mine is related to my super cool status as an asthmatic. I was using my inhaler today, right, like, before I got on and right after warm-up, and then I got the worst cotton mouth in the whole world, so they need to come up with albuterol inhalers that don't give you cotton mouth.
Or getting cotton mouth in general, like, if you're just thirsty or whatever, it's,
right.
like, the worst.
It's compounded. By the end of a ride, I feel like I have, like, you know how old people get, like, those white...
Yeah, it's the worst.
Like, that's what I feel like.
Yeah.
I've definitely, like, been out places and come back, it doesn't happen often, but I've come back and found that white stuff,
no.
and I'm like, oh, how long was that there?
You know why you get that?
Because I'm old? Yeah. Thanks, Liz.
Is that your saddle sore, how old you are?
No. My saddle sore is mean people who keep telling me that I'm old, even though I'm not.
You.
No. So here's mine. I've thought a lot about this, and I've had a bunch, and some of them make me sound like a mean old man, so I'm not going to go there. My saddle sore actually would be when young people are getting... It's a little bit twofold. When young people get into the sport and... One, and when I say get in the sport, I mean trying to be a professional.
Mm-hmm.
They get told that there's no money in horses,
yeah.
which is so far from the truth because there's a ton of money in horses. But the problem is, and this would be the second part of it, those kids have unreal expectations of what a job in horses should be.
Yeah.
So you get kids who they want at 19 years old to be able to set up a shop and teach lessons and compete horses and go to the Olympics and think that they should be able to make money doing that, when in reality, if you want to make a living in horses, it's not that difficult to do. You just have to be willing, like you would in any other career, to go live where there's opportunities to make money. So mm-hmm. not everybody is going to be fortunate enough to be able to base themselves in Ocala, Florida or Middleburg, Virginia, and be able to compete on advanced horses all over the country. But that doesn't mean that that's the industry's fault. That means right. that, you know, that's not a reality for everybody. But if you want to make a living in horses, there's so many ways to make a living in horses, whether that's being a farrier or a vet or running a boarding stable outside of a major city somewhere in the country that has good clientele that wants to learn.
Yeah.
Upland Farms. Yeah. Well, and this is a little bit what I was thinking about is like you, Liz, have set up a great business here outside of Minneapolis because it's your home.
Yeah.
Right? But you've done it because there's an opportunity to make a living here and
right.
to have a career here. And, you know, you have done a great job that way, which shows you that if you work hard enough and you're dedicated enough and you're talented, then you can do it. but I just think it bothers me sometimes that, you know, people say, oh, you can never make money in horses and this is just ridiculous and you need to go to college. I think, you know, college is great for people who are going to school to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's good for kids who are going to avoid going to real life.
Right.
Right. For sure.
I would agree.
So yeah, there you go.
Real life's hard, but you gotta work for it.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I think
that pretty much wraps it up.
It does wrap it up. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we're done?
No, just, you know, go Packers. Vikings suck.
We're going to delete that. Right?
No, if you don't, put it on my show if you do. No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for being here, and we will be back next week with another fun episode.
Awesome. I can't wait.
Bye.